Okay, so good morning. So you've had a chance to have a look through the revised new executive. I thought I'd just make a few comments and then just take questions on whatever you like. Well, I suppose as a starting point, I've used the opportunity today to both promote and introduce some new talent into the executive, taking the opportunity to refresh the responsible ministers, to create some new portfolios where I think they're required, and to modernise the names and emphasis of some of the existing portfolios. I think if there were lessons to be learned from the previous government, I think it was really a failure to rejuvenate fast enough and actually to promote the next wave of senior ministers. And so one of the big emphasis you can see today is that we are bringing through a group of ministers that we see as the next wave of senior talent and promoting them to the front bench. Just in terms of some of the new portfolios, they are in the area really around housing and national security. So let me just talk you through the national security for a moment. I've created a new ministry for national security and intelligence that I will chair. I expect my time in the that's dedicated to national security and intelligence to be as great as it was when I was the minister responsible for GCSB and SIS. I anticipate carrying on, chairing the national security meetings that I have each week, to be actively involved in the policy setting, and to continue to work in that area. But what we did do was firstly look at the international environment, so the proposal that we've got where there's a responsible minister overall for national security in the form of the Prime Minister of the day is consistent with what you see in Australia and the United Kingdom. And secondly, that was the advice of our officials who also went away and looked at this area. So we do think it makes sense to have a specific minister for GCSB and SIS. We can work through that sort of demarcation of responsibility, if you like, but I'd sort of see mine as taking that overall view around policy settings. Chris Finlayson as responsible minister will really be responsible for the most part for signing the actual specific warrants that are issued. There are a few legal responsibilities that the Attorney General has, and so they will now flow through to Amy Adams as the new Minister of Justice, who will have a capacity as the acting Attorney General to cover off those sort of legal aspects. The second sort of new area, in a way, I suppose, is around housing. So housing's a big issue, I think, for the government. It's a big issue for New Zealand, and there's specific paths to that. So what we've done there is to have Bill English as the Minister of Finance responsible for what is a very big asset now in the government's balance sheet, Housing New Zealand, about $15 billion worth of assets there. We've created the new role of the Minister for Social Housing that will be undertaken by Paul Bennett, and that really has two aspects of it. It's the customers that use that and enter with work and income. But the second thing is we do see the social housing area as a place of particular development. So over the next 3 years, I'd like to see the social housing stock in New Zealand grow. And it's one of the reasons why we established that opportunity by ensuring that income-related rents could be paid to the social housing areas. At the moment, and in New Zealand, the social housing stock is quite small, but over time, and certainly internationally, if you look at Australia, it's much, much larger. That also fits in with the local government responsibilities that Paul Bennett's got. So I think you could see over the course of the next 3 years, not so much necessarily local government, but I think organisations like the Salvation Army, Presbyterian Support and others, having a much bigger role. And that then leaves Nick Smith, who will be absolutely responsible, of course, for essentially building affordability and access for New Zealanders in general to be able to own their own hand, own home. So construction and building will fall within Nick's area. He'll also be, obviously, Nick Smith responsible as the Minister for the Environment, so responsible for the new legislation in relation to the Resource Management Act. And I'd imagine he'll go away and look at the draft legislation that's sitting there, look at whether he thinks its current structure is appropriate, and then look to introduce, as a matter of urgency, a new piece of legislation into the Parliament. Finally, I suppose, and then we can just get into any specific questions you have, in terms of speakership, it's government's intention to nominate David Carter to continue as the Speaker. The Deputy Speaker's role we'd like to see filled by Chester Burrows, so that he'll be our nomination, and we'll continue to have Lindsay Tisch as the Assistant Speaker as the government's nomination. So that's really a bit of an overall sense of an outline, and I'm happy to take any more questions you have.
The SIS changes, what's driven that? Is that you had too much time focused on that, or does that just free you up?
No, in fact, I think I'll have as much time spent in that area, if not more. But it's really to recognise actually that national security and intelligence is growing in significance and importance. And I think it does make sense to have a sort of demarcation between the workings of those ministries, if you like, which are a bit functional, and the signing of the actual warrants, to the policy settings, the national briefings, the sort of sense of where we're going to go over the course of the next 3 years. So there is going to be a demarcation, but my expectation is that Chris Winston will come to the national security briefings I get on a Tuesday morning. He'll begin to be involved in all of those issues as well. It won't stop me having a sense of who a warrant is necessarily issued against, but I won't necessarily be the signatory on that warrant.
Does it reflect the fact that the world is more of an unsafe place now? Is it more of a risk to New Zealand?
I think it's growing in significance for New Zealand in a number of fronts, both cyber security and actually, yes, you're right, I think the world has become a more uncertain place. I'd like to give a very formal speech on the area in probably about 3 or 4 weeks' time, where I hope to be able to spell out a bit more as I see the risks, for instance, around, say, foreign fighters, where I see deficiencies in the legislation. And one area which we have a particular interest is there's no question that the SIS legislation needs reforming. Now, to reform that legislation, I would much rather do that on a bipartisan basis. I was really forced to reform GCSB legislation fairly much on our own because of the need to get that legislation back in working order post the very significant deficiencies that were identified in the Kitteridge report. But what I intend to do is when Labor appoint their new leader, then what I'm going to do is see if we can work with Labor and the ISC, the committee, on the new SIS legislation. If we can't, then there's a very strong chance I won't progress changes in that area, because I'd like to do it on a bipartisan basis, but on the basis that I can, then we'll try and work with Labor and the committee to see if we can reform that legislation.
Do you see, you just mentioned deficiencies in the law, where are they? What?
Well, they might fit in a number of areas, but one of the things we're getting advice on at the moment, for instance, when you take the issue of foreign fighters, is, you know, what is our law currently, what does it allow us to do for returning foreign fighters? So just to give you one simple example, when we cancel a passport for someone looking to go overseas as a foreign fighter, it's cancelled for 12 months. In other jurisdictions, I think they have a much longer period of time, they have much greater laws supporting the government, if you like, when those people return to the country of origin. Now, we think that there are some glaring deficiencies sitting in there, but we really need to do a stocktake of that. But I can't rule out that as a result of that stocktake, I wouldn't want to necessarily make some short-term adjustments to the legislation to reflect that more dangerous environment that I think is presented by foreign fighters.
Are those changes along the lines of, you know, at the moment, if a foreign fighter or a alleged foreign fighter comes back into New Zealand, there isn't actually really a charge to be laid against
them? That's exactly right. Under the current, my interpretation of the current law, they're not necessarily guilty of any particular crime. We might want to pursue what other nationalities have done and to look at giving ourselves more authority in that area.
And would you like to do that before the overhaul of the SIS legislation, i.e. as a matter of relative urgency to catch up with the rest of the world?
Yes, so one of the intentions I've got, potentially when I give this speech in 3 or 4 weeks' time, because I think it is actually necessary for us to take a step back and talk to New Zealanders about the role of the intelligence agencies, the risks as best as I can define them for them, and where we think there might be deficiencies, and that might be the speech I use to actually outline some potential changes if they're identified. And I haven't seen the work back from the officials yet, but my guess is that there will be deficiencies.
And you want Labor's support on that?
I'd like that, yes. There are a number of issues I need to deal with, and you know, we've tried our best to work with the Leader of the Opposition and obviously the Intelligence and Security Committee, but the one thing I will do with, you know, again, teaching with David Parker, but also with our new leaders, is just have an opportunity to sit down, go through all of the issues in this area in a more detailed kind of way, so that it's, you know, potentially possible to get back to the position we had for a long period of time, which is there was unity in terms of passing national security legislation.
So just looking at Barack Obama's speech to the Security Council, where he called for greater laws in this area, around the world, is it something you see as because of what's happening with ISIS, the level of transportation of foreign fighters, is it something you see that needs to be done this year?
Yes, potentially. I guess as best as I can share the information I have with you, I think what I would say is that if I was to spell out to New Zealanders the exact number of people looking to leave and be foreign fighters, it would be larger, I think, than New Zealanders would expect that number to be. If I was to give you a sense of the number of people who are currently fighting overseas, that number is relatively small, but it's certainly far more than one or two. So the point is that there's a slightly bigger issue here than I think New Zealanders might see. And it's consistent with what I've been saying for some time, that we're not the United States or Great Britain, or even Australia, but proportionally our numbers clearly therefore are smaller, but we're not a benign environment, as some people might think.
Yeah, but looking, for instance, at the example of the young Somali New Zealand citizen who was in court in Australia last week, using his case as an example, if he got to Syria or Iraq, to Australia, he'd be charged. If you return to New Zealand, he would be allowed to walk free.
And you see, one of the things that happens is that we don't always have perfect information. So sometimes when you ask me, is there somebody in Syria, or how many people are in Syria or Iraq or other parts of the world, I can't always answer that question clearly, because I can give you sometimes the best information that I have, but I don't even have perfect information, because there are New Zealanders, for instance, that might go and live in Australia, or they might go and live in other parts of the world, and then travel to these locations. You're not always aware of that because they're not leaving from New Zealand. But of course, they have the legal right to return to New Zealand because they're New Zealand citizens. So often, some of the people we see fighting overseas are dual citizens or dual passport holders.
Yeah, so I mean, the example that, you know, what I'm getting at here is for those dual passport holders, the motivation to make sure if they get out of the war zone is to come to New Zealand where they can't be charged, rather than go back to Australia where they will be or can be.
That's right. That would be my view, is that we certainly have an easier regime, if you like, currently in place. Now, again, we're getting advice in that area, and I think we do need to go step by step and look at what our sort of like-minded countries do, what we think the law currently allows us to do. It's not always clear. And then at least identify whether we think there are holes, and if there are holes, how can we best fill those?
Because does that make us a potential haven for returning fighters of dual nationality until you fix it?
I don't think I'd use the word haven, because in reality, to come to New Zealand, you would have to be a New Zealand citizen, and the number of people in that area is small. But the number of people looking to leave is much greater than the number that New Zealanders would expect.
So do you think, Prime Minister, given the creation of this sort of ministry and the new roles for the Minister for Nursing, is that sort of like, with hindsight, does that mean that maybe it was too much for you to have as Prime Minister in that previously?
No, but I think it recognises that this is an evolving and changing space. So just in the same way that when you looked at GCSB and we reformed the legislation there, what became very clear is that cybersecurity and cybersecurity risk was far greater in the last, say, 3 years of the government than it had been in the first 3 years, and certainly far more significant issue than it had been when Helen Clark was Prime Minister. But this space is changing and evolving quite quickly, and I think in this area, it's just another example where overall, I think we're right to take the steps that the officials recommended to us, which was to establish the new structure.
How likely is that speech in 3 or 4 weeks to include the announcement of the military commitment in these files?
My understanding is that Foreign Affairs are getting closer to presenting information to the Minister and therefore to me about what our options are. I think what they'll do is effectively say, here's the list of things that we're seeing from other countries and theoretically the list available to New Zealand. And you need, as the government, to make a call on whether you want to be, you know, partly responsive or totally responsive to that issue. In the first instance, they'll almost certainly talk about the humanitarian aid that we're providing, the support we're providing in that area, and I'm sure there'll be advice to continue and potentially do more there. The question is what happens with everything else, and it's just far too early for me to tell. I haven't even seen the draft advice yet.
Have you given any more thought to sending SAS troops in a training intelligence kind of role?
No, but I'm sure that'll be part of the overall list of potential options available, because this clearly is an option in terms of intelligence gathering, intelligence support, looking at what other people around the world are doing, other countries are doing. It's pretty clear that that's an important part of what they're doing, but we'll just need to assess all of that.
Because Australia, Canada, Great Britain and the United States all have special forces either there or on the way there now. Does that add to the picture that New Zealand should send them, the fact that our allies have?
Well, we always look at what our traditional support partners are doing, and we look at where we can provide support that will make a difference. I mean, I think there is quite a difference, certainly in my mind, between intelligence gathering and providing that intelligence so that there's better information for those who might prosecute that, vis-a-vis actually physical sort of, you know, the SAS in a more combat-orientated role. So I see a bit of a demarcation, because it's not strictly always the SAS. While the SAS have capability in that area, it's not solely the SAS. Whereas I think when New Zealanders think and hear SAS on their TV sets, what they're thinking is, you know, them in a combat role, or at least a front, very much a front-line role, as we saw them in Afghanistan when they were in Kabul, for instance. So there is quite a bit of difference there, but let's just step through that and see how we go. So
in terms of intelligence, would you be comfortable with the SAS or any other aspect of the New Zealand military identifying airstrike targets in Iraq for the US Air Forces?
Potentially. Certainly, you know, the case of Iraq, the position is much clearer because of the situation around the invitation of the Iraqi government. It's a much less clear picture in Syria.
But you would be comfortable with that role, i.e. New Zealand forces identifying targets for American fighter jets, for instance?
Potentially, yes, because there may be reasons why we would want to support that.
So, Prime Minister, Chester Burrows and Craig Voss, what did they do wrong?
I don't think they've done anything wrong. In terms of Chester Burrows, we see him as a logical step in moving into the deputy speakership role. And that's really because we think he is well respected across the parliament. And always when you put up people in those roles, then you're trying to identify people that are seen as, you know, maybe a little less partisan, or someone that at least, you know, all sides of the house could have respect. And I think with Chester, they do. In the case of Craig Voss, look, he's a good minister, and he's going to remain a minister, but he's just going to serve a role outside of cabinet. And that's simply because sometimes you just have to make calls about who you want to have as your top 20. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the same way, Steve Hansen doesn't pick the same team every week. A CEO doesn't have the same lineup in their company. It's the same for me.
What about Maggie Barry? What's she done right?
Well, I think she has a lot of expertise and experience in the portfolios that we've given to her. So if you think about a long history in conservation, she's been tied from the Blue Greens for a long period of time, very strong credentials there. I think in terms of arts and culture, she'll be seen as someone that the sector will like, and I think she'll work well with the services and sector. So I think she can make a real contribution. Obviously, there are big calls to make when you pick one person out of the 2011 group and put them straight, sort of effectively, or make them the first one that goes into cabinet, but I think that she's going to prove herself to be very strong in social
housing.
Why did Barry
overthink
Goldsmith's
been into cabinet? Mix of skills, I think, to be perfectly frank. If you look at those particular areas of expertise that she has, she's very strong in those areas, and I need to pick the lineup that I think can best execute their ministerial responsibility.
Why Maggie Barry over someone like Louise Upston, though, who's been the chief whip?
Yeah, again, well, I mean, we have a lot of respect for Louise, and she's, I think, you're seeing people that we're bringing through in terms of Paul Goldsmith, you know, Louise, Joe Goodhue, Nikki Wagner. These are all people over time that could transition into cabinet. They're in a good position at the moment in terms of learning responsibilities as more junior ministers. But I can't fit everyone in day one. And there's a limit to, you know, how many spots that you have. In the end, I created an opportunity to make sure there was three. But, you know, I made more opportunities. I'd do that, but I simply don't have that room.
Is Upton being shafted, though? I mean, Maggie Barry, backbench MPs, beating her to cabinet.
No, I don't agree with that. Firstly, I think Louise would be, like anyone, and was delighted to know that she's become a minister. I think the second point is she's got a big future in front of her. I mean, you're really talking about people who are in roles that could be involved both in Parliament and hopefully in government for a very long period of time. But you know, in the case of Mandy, she has some really specific skills. And I think something we'll just bring to Parliament, a set of skills which you can harness straight away. I mean, we've had examples in the past where someone like Stephen Joyce went straight into Cabinet. Why? Because he has a set of skills that have been deployed and actually we were right to do that.
Did her garden show have anything to do with her getting conservation?
Well, I'm not a watcher of her garden show and I've got not terribly green fingers, so you're probably asking the wrong person. But look, she has performed well as an MP, but she's been actively involved in those areas. She's been a very strong proponent of the Blue Greens. Once we want to put Nick back into environment, then we need a strong advocate for conservation. Nick is not his choice.
On social housing, how are these changes of roles going to be reflected in what the government does?
Well, potentially, I think the new ministers will need to give some thought to this, but I think you will see a switch over time into certainly either, if not less, Housing New Zealand provided homes. There will be very little growth of any in that area and a substantial increase in social housing provided homes over time. That's been the mixture we've seen overseas. We've seen those social housing providers as better long-term landlords. They've had more flexibility in the way that they approach and it's a big sort of sticky asset for us in terms of Housing New Zealand. And I think governments of successive persuasions have struggled a bit with it. So we do want to see a growth in the social housing area and we are potentially prepared to put a lot more resources in that area.
So potentially capital for the asset
is often in the wrong place. You know, you can see that that's one of the reasons why we've been selling some state houses or Housing New Zealand homes, because we'll have them in the wrong location. We're not always terribly flexible. It's, you know, the previous government completely ignored the upkeep of those homes. So by the time we got there, they're in complete disrepair. You know, it's a big asset for us. Now, I think there is a better long-term approach. And look, I've started that initial work on how we're going to have a greater focus and attention for what we can do for poor children and very vulnerable children. And I think you don't have to be a rocket scientist to work out that when you look at those very vulnerable families, the big issues of attention for them are really, one of them is housing. And so if we can build the social housing stock, then that presents, I think, quite an opportunity for us to help some of those families.
Well, social housing providers say they don't have the capital to build these houses. Could the government get involved in providing that capital?
Yes, so if you think about it was either our commitment on the election campaign trail just prior to that was $100 million into that area. Now, in theory, with the income-related rents, there's a cash flow there that should allow them to actually be able to build their housing stock. That is at way too slow a rate for what the government would like to see. So if you think about $15.5 billion sitting there for housing in New Zealand and $100 million sitting in social housing, that mix is wrong. And I think there's a real opportunity here to potentially change that dynamic. And I want to see a lot more work done in that area. And potentially, as I say, if you look in Australia, you'll see very big social housing providers working with the private sector building those homes. Long-term tenancy agreements, income-related rents. There's quite a lot of stuff we can do there.
Do you think we could see a greater divestment towards or selling of Housing New Zealand stock this term?
Could see a little bit. I mean, I don't think we're crazy, but there's the capacity, I think, at least all of those ministers to think through how all of that might work. What I'm interested in is the overall number of homes that are provided for the least well-off New Zealanders. And over time, I'd like to see that number grow. It's pretty obvious that we need more. It's also obvious, I think, we need them in better condition, and we need them in the right places. And I think we'd be silly to say that the government's the sole provider here. I think there's no question, actually, that social housing providers can play a much bigger role. Now, how we make that happen is the challenge for us over the next 3 years.
Do you think, as a general rule, that some of the housing stock that might be sold is in the right place for private buyers or private developers, and the wrong place for social housing? I'm talking about in Auckland, basically.
Not necessarily. I mean, it depends. If you go and look at Tamaki as an example, that's a redevelopment that's been done essentially by Housing New Zealand. And there's no question at the end of that you're going to have a lot better mix of your stock. So you're going to have a lot more 1 and 2 bedrooms, and then you're going to have some quite big homes, and it'll be a much better fit on the land that you've got there. The question is, can you do that in the social housing area? Could you do some quite big developments and have them as much more significant players? Now, we'll need to sit down with that sector, but I suspect you might find Salvation Army, Presbyterian Support, others in that grouping might say, you know, under the right conditions, with the right support from the government, with the right level of capital, where we might be an investor there, but not necessarily running the whole thing, that all might work quite well. But there's a lot of policy work to be done. We haven't started doing that yet.
The new security ministry that you're going to hear,
yes.
How much more money are you going to need? You know, is it going to need to be quite a big boost in the budget for our security services?
Over time, there needs to be more money allocated to effectively GCSB and SIS. I think you can see that is there. They have increasing demands on them. It's increasing sophistication about what they do. They just need better capability, I think. So there will be more money going there. In terms of, you know, Accenture, I suppose, the ministry that I look after, the National Security Intelligence, I don't see that being... I think that's very policy rich and very specific in terms of people, so it won't be sucking up a lot of resources. But if I just go back to when I first became Prime Minister in 2008 and think about the way national security was approached then, and think about how it's resourced now, the role of Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, the level of sophistication of those briefings that I get, I mean, they are light years away from where they were 6 years ago. And I strongly suggest 6 years from now, they'll be in a different place to where they are now. And that reflects the global nature and threats that we face.
Yeah, Helen, once famously described the New Zealand living in a benign environment. How would you describe the environment which New Zealand now finds itself in?
Well, she may well have been right at the time that it was a benign strategic environment, but I think that's just not correct today. I don't want to overstate those things, but nor do I want to understate them. The reality is that some of these risks that we're seeing play out in places like Australia could easily present themselves in New Zealand. We just need to be cognizant.
That shutdown that we're talking about, you're looking at the sort of corresponding build-up to the thing that side of this expansion?
Well, essentially when we redid the GCSB legislation, you saw a very significant increase in the level of resources for the inspector, and you know that became a full-time position with deputies, much more resources going into that space now for Sherwin as opposed to with Paul Nasals in that job. Ultimately, the SIS legislation changes that we can foreshadow are more about technical capability and modernising what is legislation that's very old. So the oversight should continue to be at the sort of level that was dictated in the GCSB law, because that's where it was coming.
Macaulay and Grocer have both slipped a bit and lost some portfolio responsibilities. Why is that? Why is Macaulay lost Sport and Rec?
Yeah, so if you just go to Sport and Rec for a second, what I've done is promoted, obviously, Jonathan Coleman, who I see as being potentially very strong as a replacement for Tony Ryle as Minister of Health. And the thinking there is that Jonathan's done a good job in the past. He's a former doctor, but also has an MBA, so he's got both economic and medical skills. By giving him Sport and Rec, the reason I've done that is I want him to focus on the issue of obesity, and so I want him to use the link between sport to look at that issue of obesity. What I've done with Murray is asked him to continue as the associate Minister of Sport and Recreation, but with a focus on high performance sports. So that's the difference between the two. And actually, Murray's very comfortable about that.
So Murray holds America's Cup
and the events. Well, he'll continue to be very focused on things like Commonwealth Games, Olympic Games.
Can I get a quick update on the power crisis? Are you getting updated on that?
Yeah.
Is that something you're worried about?
Well, there's two things I'd say. I mean, firstly, it's good news that VECTA is working quickly to restore power to the remaining households. I think they've halved the number now, so there's under 20,000 households left. The second thing is there will need to be an inquiry into what effectively went wrong, but also the redundancy and the response to what went wrong. We know there's a fire. The question is, was there enough redundancy built in there? The only thing I will say is that if as a result of the inquiry, we say that much more redundancy needs to be built in. That may be right, and I don't want to prejudge that. But if we say that, the one point I'll make is that will feed into higher power prices, because VECTA is a controlled monopoly, and its costs and charging are dictated by the Commerce Commission. So ultimately, when you look at power increases over the last 6 years that I've been Prime Minister, what you've really seen is you haven't seen an increase in underlying power that much, but you've seen a cost transfer as we've upgraded the national grid and as the power companies have had to invest more in their infrastructure. Now, that might end up being the right thing to do with Vector, that they do ultimately invest more. But my only point is that I know people will say, deliver me the gold-plated solution, but the gold-plated solution has implications for consumers. Okay.